The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter, and then from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And I'm going to start by just finishing up a little bit of information about reducing the risk of Alzheimer's disease from the Harvard Health Letter of January 2025. There's a side section that begins by saying that for today, it is suggested that you practice lifestyle adjustments that may reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. The idea that microbes may trigger some cases of Alzheimer's is unproven and not widely accepted, but the evidence is growing stronger. The idea does fit, however, with previous research showing the importance of amyloid beta, tau, APOE4, and neuroinflammation as causes of Alzheimer's. Invoking microbes in some cases of Alzheimer's does not replace the older ideas. Instead, it fits with and possibly completes the older ideas. And it goes on to say that there are ways to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's disease. First, sleep at least 7 hours a night. As you sleep, your brain flushes out waste material and toxins, including amyloid beta. Use stress reduction techniques. Stress activates brain areas that internalize emotion, and cells in those brain areas may make more amyloid and undergo more inflammation under stress. Interact with friends. If solitude causes stress and loneliness, it increases the risk for Alzheimer's. Exercise daily. Aerobic exercise promotes the birth of new brain cells. Learn new things. This creates new brain cell connections. Eat a healthy diet. Floss your teeth regularly. Flossing, along with brushing, reduces gum disease. Gum disease increases the amounts of potentially harmful mouth bacteria. And finally, you should get immunizations. Vaccines greatly reduce the risk of serious infection. And people with serious infections have a greater risk of Alzheimer's disease. Now we're going to turn to an area called news briefs in the Harvard Health Letter. And the first question is, what's the best self-fitting strategy for over-the-counter hearing aids? Self-fitting over-the-counter hearing aids are affordable and easy to use. You match them to your needs in one of two ways, with self-adjustment, which allows you to manually adjust bass, treble, amplification, and other sound aspects, or with in-situ audiometry, an automated fitting based on a hearing test administered through a smartphone app. Which strategy is best? Well, it's a tie according to a small randomized trial published in JAMA Otolaryngology. Researchers asked 28 people with confirmed mild to moderate hearing difficulty to try over-the-counter hearing aids and randomly assigned them to a pair with one of the self-fitting strategies. Once participants were happy with their settings, an audiologist checked them for accuracy. Participants were encouraged to use the hearing aids for a month. After that, participants switched to the alternative type of self-fitting device and used that for a month. Both strategies were effective. The self-adjustment hearing aids generated higher satisfaction rates and more consistent use than the devices with in-situ audiometry. This may be because self-adjustment provides greater control in tailoring hearing aid devices to personal preferences. The next short article is entitled Resilience Tied to a Longer Life. Feeling burdened by tough times or extra stress? Bolster your resilience, your ability to cope with and adapt to challenging circumstances and events. And a study published online September 3rd, 2024, by BMJ Mental Health suggests that being resilient might even help you live longer. Researchers assessed the response of more than 10,000 people who answered questionnaires every other year for 12 years. Participants shared information about various aspects of their lives, health, income, family, and psychological health, including perseverance, calmness, sense of purpose, and self-reliance. Based on that information, scientists calculated a resilience score for each participant. Compared with people who had the lowest resilience score, those with the highest were up to 38% less likely to die in the next decade, even after scientists factored in poor health or an unhealthy lifestyle. The study is observational and can't prove that resilience protects people against premature death, but it won't hurt to boost your ability to bounce back from adversity. Do that by meditating, drawing support from friends, and focusing on things that are going well or things for which you're grateful. What are the worst ultra-processed foods for your heart? It's time to break up with your lunchtime deli sandwich and soda. A massive Harvard study has found that sugary drinks and processed meats are the worst of the worst for health, heart health. Ultra-processed foods are items that undergo so much change that their original ingredients aren't recognizable, like dehydrated soups, potato chips, packaged baked goods, and microwavable dinners. The foods are loaded with unhealthy fat, salt, sugar, preservatives, and artificial ingredients. When scientists looked at the health and dietary information of more than 200,000 adults collected over 30 years and combined the findings with those from 19 other studies for a total of 1.25 million people, they found a link between eating ultra-processed foods and greater risk for stroke and heart attack. For example, those who ate the most ultra-processed food had a 17% higher chance of developing cardiovascular disease compared with those who ate the least. When researchers divided the foods into categories, the riskiest for heart health were sugary drinks and processed meats. Anything salted, cured, smoked, or fermented. The findings were published September 5th, 2024, in The Lancet Regional Health Americas. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Women's Health Watch. Again, this is the January 2025 issue. And the first article is entitled, Beyond the Milestone, Health Goals for Your 50s and Onward. Ideally, reaching your 50s feels like hitting your stride. Once lofty goals, raising a family, climbing the career ladder, traveling far and wide, are now threads in the rich tapestry you've spent decades creating. But there's every reason to expect you'll keep weaving. With the average life expectancy in the United States hovering around 77.5 and topping 80 for women, you likely have decades more to plan. And this strategizing should include reflecting on your health and ways to maximize it going forward. What you do in your 50s will definitely pay dividends or harm you in the long term. So it's really a decade to start setting some health goals, says Dr. Deborah Qualick, an internal medicine doctor and menopause expert at both Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital. The timing is especially apt since the odds of developing a chronic disease like arthritis, diabetes, or heart disease rise as we hit the half-century mark and beyond. 95% of adults 55 and older have at least one chronic condition, while nearly 80% have two or more, according to the National Council on Aging. Our 50s are when many of us are in the thick of menopause, coping with hormone fluctuations and related symptoms like hot flashes, vaginal dryness, achy joints, and brain fog. Diminished estrogen can also boost our risk for high blood pressure, prediabetes, heart disease, and thinning bones. These health issues can chip away at our ability to optimize the years ahead, to do everything we want and feel good while we're doing it. If you're someone who feels young and healthy at 50, you may think the party goes on forever, and you can keep doing the same things you did at 30, says Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. But we often think about 50 as when aging really starts. You get your first AARP card, but it's also a bit of an inflection point in your risk for heart disease and various cancers. The longer we wait to take stock of our health, the worse it can get. Dr. Sands and Dr. Qualick highlight an array of worthwhile health goals, why they're relevant, and ways to accomplish them. First, you should improve your balance. Most people are not going to be falling when they're 50. But the things we do when we're 50 have a bearing on what happens when we're 80. Dr. Sands says, balance is a crucial issue. Falls are the leading cause of injury for adults 65 and older, according to the CDC. Avoiding that scenario can be as simple as incorporating balance-boosting activities, including dancing, tai chi, yoga, and alternatively standing on one foot for a minute or longer. Make sure your eyes and ears are healthy, too. 50 is still young for this, but if you have hearing or sight problems, that can lead to balance problems. Next, you should learn a new skill. Always want to take up piano or speak Mandarin? Starting now offers more than a dose of midlife novelty. Research indicates it might stave off cognitive decline. Learning a new skill is helpful because we're getting outside our comfort zone, which helps keep our brains sharp, Dr. Sands says. It also is helpful from a mental health standpoint. Aging is the top risk factor for developing cancer, according to the National Cancer Institute. But screening tests can detect abnormal cells early, increasing your odds of beating the disease. By your 50s, you should already have been screened for breast, cervical, and colorectal cancer. If you've been a smoker, you should also ask your doctor about low-dose CT lung cancer screening. 50 is a bit of an artificial cutoff because there's a continuum of risk, Dr. Sands says. It's certainly the latest point we want to start screening for these things, the tipping point. Bone loss starts to ramp up around age 50, especially in women. Women are four times more likely than men to develop osteoporosis as older adults, placing them at higher risk of devastating fracture that can prove debilitating or even shorten lives. Medication and lifestyle measures, like beefing up calcium and vitamin D intake, can mitigate the problem, and so can weight-bearing exercise. Hormone therapy can also help since 10% of women's bone mass is lost in the 2 to 3 years surrounding the menopausal transition. It's a pain point for women because women have both hormone and age-related bone loss, and it accelerates in the 50s, Dr. Qualick says. Without treatment, a fair number of women suffer osteoporotic fractures as they get into their 60s. It's also very important to maintain muscle strength. Few things gird your body better for healthy aging than strong muscles. We start losing muscle mass in our 30s, a process that accelerates dramatically as decades accrue. An underappreciated fact is that muscle loss doesn't just weaken us, it also contributes to slowing our metabolism, fueling weight gain. Strength and resistance training is the best antidote. It's really foundational to your health and not something you should put off. I hear stories about people who start working out in their 60s and 70s, and they definitely benefit, but ideally you should start younger. Maintaining robust muscles doesn't require spending hours and hours in the gym, Dr. Sands notes. You can do so much to improve your muscle mass simply by doing body weight exercises at home, like planks, squats, wall sits, lunges, and push-ups. And you should pay closer attention to your diet. Speaking of muscle loss, eating sufficient protein works in tandem with exercise to help stem the problem. Look to protein-rich foods like fish, tofu, poultry, eggs, nuts, and lentils. We need more protein than most people take in, Dr. Sands says. Eat protein with at least two of your meals every day. It's going to be hard to hold on to muscle mass unless you have the building blocks. It's also wise to aim for a plant-forward diet that limits or eliminates red meat and processed foods. The dietary choices we make affect our weight as well as our risk for heart disease and cancer, Dr. Sands says. Granted, much of this health advice is valid regardless of age. Why pay closer attention now? Not solely to live longer, Harvard experts say. If you're serious about taking care of your health now, you're extending the part of your life where you're fit and well, Dr. Qualick says. Dr. Sands drives this point home by asking patients what kind of life they imagine when they're 70, 75, or beyond. Do you want to be active, enjoy your grandchildren, be able to travel? What goals do you have, and how are you going to achieve them? Part of it is making sure your vehicle, your body, is going to be able to support you in these goals. By the time you're half a century old, your body is starting to break down. Although there are no guarantees, you can do things to avoid falls, frailty, cancer, and heart disease. You should do what you can to tip the odds in your favor. And now we're going to turn to a section in the Harvard Women's Health Watch that is called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Tony Golan, Editor-in-Chief. And the first question is, I'm mesmerized by people who purposefully sit in cold water to improve their health. Are there any benefits? And Dr. Golan says, it does take a certain bravado to immerse yourself in cold water, but while they feel quite frosty, most ice baths take place in water that's between 50 and 60 degrees. Many athletes use them as a way to dampen muscle pain and alleviate soreness. Research that teases out the potential benefits of ice baths is scant. They're believed to lower stress, reduce fatigue, speed up workout recovery, and even increase sex drive, but scientific evidence is inconclusive. Before plunging in, you should know that ice baths can be risky. Hypothermia can begin to set in within minutes of being immersed in water that is less than 65 degrees. And sudden submersion in water that's 60 degrees or lower can shock your body, causing rapid breathing, involuntary gasping, and spikes in heart rate and blood pressure. Never take an ice bath without someone nearby, and stay in for a maximum of 15 minutes. The next question is, my doctor is worried I might have obstructive sleep apnea and recommended a formal sleep study. What will it involve? And Dr. Golan responds, suspected sleep apnea, repeated pauses in breathing while you sleep, is one of the main reasons to conduct a sleep study. The initial test can often be done at home. It sounds like your doctor recommends a more complete sleep study done overnight in a special lab. You'll be hooked up to sensors and electrodes that record the electrical activity in your brain while you sleep, as well as monitor snoring, eye and body movements, blood oxygen, and breathing rates. To help you relax, you can wear your usual sleepwear and bring any other necessary comforts. You'll also be able to move around as needed, including using the bathroom or getting into a comfortable sleep position. A technician will monitor you throughout the night, and a sleep specialist will analyze the resulting data to determine if you have sleep apnea or another sleep disorder. Next in the Harvard Women's Health Watch is an interesting article that's entitled Pap Smears or Self Swabs. There's a new option for cervical cancer screening. At the gynecologist's office, we know the drill. Don a disposable gown, lie on the exam table, place our feet in stirrups, and wait for the doctor to insert a speculum, a metal tool that separates the vaginal walls and allows the doctor to insert a long swab to scrape cells from the cervix. It's all part of the Pap test, which is performed as part of a pelvic exam. This mainstay screening test detects cervical cancer, which is diagnosed in nearly 14,000 American women every year and kills about 4,400. If those numbers seem low, it's because routine screening with Pap tests enables far more women to detect and treat precancerous changes and prevent cervical cancer from developing. Globally, cervical cancer is the fourth most common cancer in women, according to the WHO. For many, getting a Pap test is a fraught, sometimes painful encounter that leaves them feeling physically or emotionally vulnerable. This scenario is hardly optimal for an important procedure. While the incidence of early-stage cervical cancer has dropped in most groups, in recent years, advanced cervical cancer cases haven't declined in any racial, ethnic, or age groups over nearly two decades. But now there's an alternative. A new self-swab test enables women to collect a cell sample in their doctor's office independent of a pelvic exam without the need for stirrups or speculum. The cells are then sent to a lab to look for strains of human papillomavirus implicated in the development of cervical cancer. Approved by the FDA in 2024, the self-swab test was made possible by recent technological advances in HPV screening. Pelvic exams are uncomfortable for everyone, says Dr. Stephanie Alamina. It involves such a sensitive and private area that we're not used to showing many people, and it's particularly sensitive for people who have had trauma in the past. It's tough to be a patient on the receiving end of that exam. The Pap test can certainly add to that discomfort. The self-swab test allows women more autonomy than a traditional Pap test, which is performed by a clinician as part of a pelvic exam, but it's not yet a private process. Instead, a clinician coaches the woman through the procedure, guiding her to part the labia, insert a plastic swab, which is about the size of a pen, rub it along the vaginal walls, and remove it. The swab is then immediately placed in a vial and sent to a lab. The FDA hasn't weighed in on whether the clinician stays behind a curtain during this procedure or watches the woman insert the swab. I think most gynecologists assume this occurs in the restroom or a clinic room without the healthcare provider present. However, the patient has seen the healthcare provider immediately prior to the self-swab to discuss how to perform the testing. The new test development is part of a shifting model of cervical cancer testing. In use for 80 years, the Pap test has always looked at abnormal cells from the cervix. In recent years, the same cell sample has also been used to check for HPV. It turns out the latter test is better at predicting future cervical cancer. Labs run both tests at the same time. But in the last 10 years, we've realized that detecting HPV is much more predictive of a problem than looking at cells from the cervix alone. So we're moving to a new paradigm of doing an HPV test first. If it's positive, only then will a woman need to return for a pap smear to determine if cells on the cervix are abnormal. Testing positive for HPV is not unusual, so the follow-up test is needed to truly figure out whether an abnormality is present. When caught early through routine screening, cervical cancer is curable. In the United States, about 92% of women with early stage cervical cancer survive 5 years or longer. The self-swab test has some benefits. It's more palatable and it's accurate. Pap and HPV tests completed with a pelvic exam have reduced the overall risk of cervical cancer. The self-swab test can meet the same objective. Self-swabbing can be just as accurate in terms of HPV testing and help us decide who needs cervical testing. It's hoped that the self-swab technique will boost access to screening. More women may seek cervical cancer screening if they don't need a pelvic exam to get it. In this way, the self-swab test may combat disparities in cervical cancer detection and treatment. For example, Black women have a 30% higher risk of the disease than other groups and are 60% more likely to die. And a quarter of women eligible for cervical cancer screening are overdue to get it. If we can take away some of the barriers, I hope the disparities can roll away, she says. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.